Welcome back to the program. We talk a great deal in the political context of still fighting the culture wars of the 60s. Yet in that discussion, we sometimes miss the larger points of what really changed in that period. It wasn't just politics and war and drugs and race. It was a fundamental change in how we view ourselves as individuals and our place in the world. The Human Potential Movement, born in the early 60s, sought to address how we see ourselves and how we would be more empowered as individuals. This was very different than the organization man that grew out of World War II. We see the flowering of this change even in some of the pop culture of today, shows like Mad Men, for example. My guest today, Jessica Grogan, has taken a look at the whole history of this movement in her new book, Encountering America: Humanistic Psychology, 60s Culture, and the Shaping of the Modern Self. Jessica Grogan has a PhD in American Studies from the University of Texas at Austin. She's taught courses in American history, culture, and psychology. And it is my pleasure to welcome Jessica Grogan to the program to talk about Encountering America. Jessica, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Jeff.
Good to have you here. Certainly coming out of World War II, the whole notion of individual growth, of finding meaning in one's life, I mean, that was a concept that virtually didn't exist.
No, there was a real emphasis that within psychology and the psychology that was transmitted to people in the wider culture that was similar to the kind of conformity and adjustment focus that we think about when we think of the 50s. So within psychology, it was about behaviorism, and also everything had to be kind of validated by empirical research studies. So moving into the 60s, that's where you see this shift towards thinking about what we're capable of and thinking about people more fully, thinking about their subjectivity, their thoughts, and their feelings, which was something we'd been ignoring for at least a couple of decades.
But to get there, there was a period that we went through this sense of alienation, of isolation that individuals felt.
Yeah, I think a lot of what happened in the 60s was actually born out of some of that isolation and that dissatisfaction. So there was a feeling that we weren't really getting people right, you know, just kind of conforming or wearing a gray flannel suit or something. You were feeling like there was something about your individuality that was suppressed. And so a lot of the liberation movements that came up in the 60s probably related to that sense.
And there was this popular book at the time, The Lonely Crowd, by David Reisman, that kind of gave voice to that people began to take notice of.
Right. So you're seeing a lot of these more kind of communal, collectivist activities, and that is one aspect of humanistic psychology and the human potential movement, is these encounter groups where people go on retreats and share their feelings and their secrets and their thoughts with these bigger groups of people and have this community sense, which they had been lacking.
How did it find its place in the therapeutic movement? I mean, Freudian psychology was sort of the gold standard at that moment in time. How did that facade begin to crack?
Well, I mean, in the 50s in particular, Carl Rogers, his idea of client-centered therapy really got a lot of attention, and moving into the 60s, that kind of overtook psychoanalysis. I mean, the difference is being, when psychoanalysis was king, you were laying on a couch and your psychotherapist wasn't doing a lot of speaking. Once in a while would give an analysis of you, but here you were finding yourself sitting face to face with your psychotherapist. They might share things about themselves, their feelings and their thoughts, and it was much more genuine human interaction.
Much of this came out of what was going on in Europe at the time, this kind of holistic approach. Talk a little about that.
One of the themes in the book is this idea of gestalt psychology, which is looking at the whole person, the idea that people made more sense if we saw them in their totality instead of reducing them into these different parts. And so things like behaviorism, looking only at specific behaviors or anything that you could quantify in a laboratory, was really reducing people to these parts. Whereas Gestalt, the goal was to see people in their fullness. So you wanted as much data as possible about people and their experience. You wanted to know, if you were doing a research study, you would want to know how they felt during that research study, what their response was to it, and kind of anything that you could consider.
How did the rise of European existentialism play a role, if at all, in the evolution of these therapeutic attitudes here in America?
Well, existentialism, in terms of psychotherapy, really made it to the U.S. in the 50s when Rollo May published a book called Existence, and he actually did some of the first translations of really important works on existentialism. And this relates also to what you were saying about this sense of isolation that people tended to have during that time. One of the things was that people had existential anxiety. They were worried that one day they would die, and this was a reasonable anxiety. This wasn't something we should either take Valium for or therapize away. And so they started to think, well, this is our predicament, and this is something we need to work within the confines of and think about the meaning of, rather than kind of pretending it doesn't exist.
There was also some evolution of what went on in, of all places, the military during the Second World War, and psychological profile, and some of this even grew out of that.
Right. So the rise of psychology in America really did come from World War II, in terms of testing and sorting military into different categories based on, you know, what their aptitude was or even their personality. So, there was that quantification, but then psychology had kind of grown so much during that time period that it went in all these other directions after the war as well.
Talk a little bit about Carl Rogers, specifically what he laid out and what the public reaction to it was, particularly within the psychotherapeutic community.
Well, Carl Rogers was one of the first, I think he was the first person in America to publish an actual transcript of a psychotherapy session. And so it included all of the ums and huhs and awkward pauses that therapists might make, because therapists aren't perfect, and showed that the kind of the struggling to have an authentic communication that's characteristic of any human interaction. So he really humanized the idea of what happened in therapy. There had kind of been this veil in front of it before, and people thought it was this mysterious process, and it was represented in film as you would, you know, unearth your deeply repressed material, then you would be cured. But Rogers really showed that it was this much more common human process to sit down in therapy with someone and to be accepted and to have this kind of nurturing environment in which you can grow and you can begin to move forward if you had been stuck. So Rogers really reoriented our cultural perception of what psychotherapy could be and gave average people a sense that it was kind of something that they could handle. It was something more normal, and so that relates to the normalization of going to therapy.
And how did the Freudians respond to that?
Well, the Freudians had become neo-Freudians, so there were a lot of different schools represented among them, and really a lot of neo-Freudians were interested in some of these humanistic themes. They were interested in, some like Adler, were interested in considering like people's feeling about the community and communitarian action and things like that. So it wasn't really that far away from some of what was happening in psychoanalysis. It kind of slipped in. And some of the humanistic psychologists themselves had some affinity for psychoanalysis and wanted to build on what psychoanalysis had done rather than just negate what came before.
Talk about Rollo May, as also you mentioned him before, as one of the pioneers of this and what approach he took.
Well, Rollo May, he actually wrote his dissertation in his first book on the meaning of anxiety. And so this was getting back to that existential theme, the idea that we all had this, there was this basic anxiety in being alive, which was just trying to make sense of life in the context of the fact that it would one day end. So Rollo May was kind of the more philosophical end of this movement. And a lot of the stuff that happened in the human potential movement in the 60s and going into the 70s, and much of it in California, was not exactly what he had intended. I mean, he really had an interest more in considering existential themes, in considering applying them to psychotherapy and seeing ourselves as, you know, being fully present and finding ways to exist in the world that were more meaningful than ways that had been kind of advocated in the past.
Why was California such a center of this?
Well, it's interesting because a lot of the people who started human psychology began in academic institutions in the Northeast and some in the Midwest. And almost all of them left for California in the course of the 60s. I think what they found was an openness, a general cultural receptivity, like, to these ideas, to kind of the idea of finding yourself or reaching your potential or experimenting with things that were less traditional. So there was a lot of, I mean, most of the country's innovative research at the time was happening in California, and there was kind of an attitude that went with that, which suggested some kind of openness to these new ideas.
And, of course, you talk about Esalen as one of the pantheons of what was going on.
Right. So Esalen being which was in Big Sur, being this outpost of the human potential movement where a lot of these encounter groups were happening, but also where there was a clash with some of the intentions of humanistic psychologists and these countercultural developments, including psychedelic use and sexual promiscuity and things like that.
I want to go back and talk a little bit about Abraham Maslow, who in many ways humanized a lot of what we've been talking about.
Right. So Maslow, I mean, he did humanize it, but he was also very popular with corporate America. So he found ways, I mean, in the 50s, his theory of human motivation, which if anyone knows about Maslow is the thing they're probably most familiar with, this pyramid of motivation where we, as we move to higher levels, we have kind of higher and higher interests. At the highest level, we care about beauty and truth and morality and things like that. So, I mean, he really talked about, he tried to study specific people who were healthy or were incredibly successful and to think about what they had and what we might want to emulate. So what he wanted to do was think about what do we value, what is a good life, what are we trying to be. So he kind of put it in that kind of language for people.
He also pushed this idea, probably more than others, of personal growth, of individual growth.
Yeah, he was very focused on the individual. Though one thing I tried to do in my book was find these intersections between his interest in the individual and humanistic psychology in general, his interest in the individual and the culture, because he really was also interested in what was happening in civil rights and women's lib and things like that. So his idea was that we were going to remake the culture by remaking individuals, but over the course of his life, that began to change, and he began to think we needed to kind of set our sights higher, maybe at a cultural level as well.
In many ways, it was the reverse. I mean, the culture changed as a result of individual change.
Right. And I think that was the original intention of humanistic psychology, particularly humanistic psychotherapy. The idea was if you can heal these individuals, then the culture will respond.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the invention or the intervention of drugs into this, particularly LSD and Timothy Leary's involvement in the movement.
Well, I think when Leary in particular started experimenting with LSD, humanistic psychologists were pretty supportive of it. I mean, they felt like this was something that could give us new information about human consciousness and the things that we're capable of. And Maslow himself had this theory of peak experiences, and LSD experiences were kind of the closest artificial thing that we had ever seen to those peak experiences that we get from just kind of in our daily life, in our normal lives, you know, maybe the birth of your child or something that really causes you to have this moment that feels perfect in all ways. So they felt like it was really interesting and it could give us data about human experience. But as anyone who knows about Leary knows, that things kind of went downhill as he got more and more sidetracked by just doing LSD.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that happened in general, I think, in the movement and at Esalen. There were just kind of a lot of people squatting at Esalen, doing a lot of drugs, not really taking seriously the goals of the human potential movement, not really interested in genuine growth. So as that developed, Maslow and others started to feel like it was threatening to the goal of reaching your full potential. And that he said, you can't take a shortcut to human potential. It's like taking an elevator to the top of Mount Everest.
Mm-hmm. The other area that seemed to go over the cliff that you talk about were the idea of these encounter groups and the extremities that happened in some of those.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, for me, in the project of the book, this was by far the most fascinating thing. So the encounter groups, where they could be couples or individuals, would go and spend a weekend, essentially a marathon, where you were discouraged from sleeping at all. And as you got more and more tired, your inhibitions would break down. In these groups, there was a lot of very emotional expression, confrontations. Sometimes there was physical violence. People were encouraged to do things like arm wrestling and growling and kind of all these things to unleash emotion. And a lot of the people who experienced these felt like it really changed them dramatically. Whether or not that change endured is really up for grabs, and some people would say it didn't. But at the time, there was so much enthusiasm around them that certain people actually tried to extend them, in particular George Leonard, who is the editor for Look magazine, and Price Cobbs, a black psychiatrist who's in San Francisco. They tried to extend them to interracial understanding. So they held some racial encounter groups at Esalen and also just in San Francisco during the late 60s, and felt like kind of airing all of our feelings, our complicated feelings about race, to people of other races was a way that we could break through some of these barriers.
Another movement that had its underpinnings in all of this that you write about is the women's movement. Talk a little bit about that and the nexus that happened here.
Well, I think the earliest manifestation of these humanistic themes in the women's movement was with Betty Friedan's publication of The Feminine Mystique in 1962, and she was very influenced by Maslow herself. She had actually been in a graduate program, I think, at Berkeley in psychology, which was very psychoanalytic at the time, but then read Maslow and felt like this really resonated with her, this idea of human potential, and particularly with her understanding of women's experience in the U.S. So she specifically mentions Maslow in that book, but then going forward in the development of women's liberation into the late 60s, you see a lot of these themes of reaching your full potential, and the ways that anything that would block you from doing that would be really problematic. And you also see consciousness-raising groups, which have interesting similarities to encounter groups.
Talk about what happened in the 70s as some of these movements began to run their course. I mean, certainly they had lasting influence, and we'll talk a little bit about that, but some of the specifics started to run their course in the mid to late 70s.
Right. So the humanistic psychology movement in general, I just saw kind of waning numbers and fewer people interested in encounter groups and things like that. My book goes up to 1980, which I thought to be kind of an endpoint of this, particularly with Reagan's election and kind of a shift away from some liberal cultural values, which really had made way for humanistic psychology. I mean, it's a little hard to speculate on, you know, why things started to wane, but in a way that movements do, it kind of had a rise when it was a really perfect cultural moment, and then when there's a push back, it starts to wane again. But one of the things I argue is that humanistic psychology, well, the movement itself kind of stepped out of the cultural spotlight, but the ideas are really, they just saturated our culture.
Talk about that, because we talk even today about the inherent therapeutic culture that we live in, and that is a direct result of what we've been talking about.
Right. So, I mean, a lot of the, just even the language of human potential, the idea that we need to be fully ourselves, or we need to reach our full potential, that these are things that we talk about in our marriages or in our relationships. And you feel like if you're in a job that's kind of holding you back from that, or in a marriage or something, then it's really cause for concern, might be a reason to go to therapy, might be a reason to change your situation. But in general, this idea, a psychology of health or happiness, I mean, we hear the most recent incarnation of this is positive psychology, and just kind of thinking about our concern with this, with living, you know, a good life, or what that looks like and what satisfaction looks like. Whereas prior to this time period, psychology was really about pathologizing people. It was just about diagnosing and finding people who deviated from the cultural norm, rather than really looking towards the potential or what it might look like to be healthy and successful.
And what's particularly interesting is the way these ideas have stayed constant as they've passed to a couple of generations now.
Right. Yeah, and it's something that we take for granted, which I found interesting in writing the book, is just kind of looking at all of the things that are present now, also in psychotherapy. I mean, if anyone goes to psychotherapy now, they're going to see a pretty humanistic form of psychotherapy. And even cognitive behavioral approaches fall under this umbrella. One of the earliest cognitive behavioral texts by Albert Ellis was called Humanistic Therapy, I think. There is this way that it's kind of all around us. It's what's available to us in terms of help is this humanistic psychology, and we don't even identify it as such necessarily.
Jessica Grogan, her book is Encountering America, Humanistic Psychology, 60s Culture, and the Shaping of the Modern Self. Jessica, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it.